You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of August 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tyler Brulé. Today, I'm with our very own Steve Bloomfield and also Matt Alagaya, with trousers today, I need to say, to look back at some of the week's biggest stories. It's warm in London, ladies and gentlemen. First, we're in Italy following this week's deadly earthquake. Matteo Renzi promises to rebuild destroyed areas, but are some towns lost forever? In Germany, migration has pushed population growth to its highest level since 1992. We'll count the challenges and opportunities. In France, the country's top court has overturned one town's ban on the so-called burkini. We'll dip our toes into that debate fleetingly, plus the wisdom of self-driving cars and the future of local newspaper. That's all in Midori House with me, Tyler Brulé. So, welcome to Studio One on a rather balmy Friday, but we're not complaining, are we, Steve Bloomfield? It's toasty upstairs, but it's only toasty because I think our Yoshi Takagi is anti-air conditioning.
He is indeed. It's
cool biz.
Yeah,
Japanese love cool biz.
It's very much cool biz. Also, it's like...
You're dressed kind of cool biz.
Well, you know, I'm trying to.
I mean, I'm not saying the salaryman way, but you've sort of got the dress shirt, but it's, you know, it's short sleeves.
But it's short sleeves, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, because I'm not a shorts person in the office. I know a number of gentlemen.
I think I've only seen your legs once. On a beach or somewhere, anyway. Now, yeah, that's saying a lot. I mean, yeah, we go back almost a decade at this point.
We do, actually.
We do.
Yeah, we do.
I mean, there was your time in Africa and everything.
I know, but still, yeah. It's been a long time. Let's not dwell on that now.
No. Let's talk about Matt Alagaya's legs.
I'm safely wearing jeans today, yeah. Which actually is not very comfortable.
Because most of the people know you for your chest.
Of course.
Around here.
Absolutely.
Almost as much chest as Justin Trudeau has been flaunting of late. How do you feel about that, of
course? Justin Trudeau's chest.
Well, because you man the diplomatic pages of this fine magazine, I think there's just been a few too many shots of the Canadian PM, you know, bears in the background, wedding, PM and his, you know, chest out.
Indeed. And there's bear been, you know, and I'm not saying this because I feel like I'm not as strong as Justin Trudeau, because I'm clearly not as strong as Justin Trudeau. I'm not even going there. But the yoga poses, the whole thing.
Yeah, come on, get
up
on the edge of the table. Cantilever off the edge, right?
Yeah. I mean, I would, Tyler, but obviously the studio's a bit too cozy for that. I think, yes. The image is, hey, look, there are a few other politicians that can do this.
Right, and
so
also because
enough.
The only reference point that we have in contemporary terms is Putin on a horse, right?
Well, indeed.
Or maybe fishing or wrestling a bear.
But even those politicians that even sort of still slightly in your mind's eye you think of as relatively young. I was listening to an interview the other day with Tony Blair, which mentioned that he's 63 now.
Really?
You know, exactly. When actually, obviously, he would be 63. It makes sense. But... still, in your mind, he's still like, oh, the young prime minister.
Because it's 20 years since, 20 years since he came into power.
Good math there.
Yeah, I know. I did a quick sum there.
Glad you're the economics correspondent. Well done.
One other reason, Tyler, why it is a little bit warmer on the editorial floor right now is because it's packed, because everyone's here, because it's production week, production day, really. We're sending the October issue. We're almost sort of on track, aren't we?
I think we're doing reasonably well. It is a bank holiday in the UK this weekend.
So no one wants to work this weekend.
Added incentive for most people. I should ask, Matt, where are you off to this weekend?
I might be off to France, actually.
What do you mean, might?
Well, I haven't decided yet.
You don't know yet.
I know.
Because I think Eurostar might be quite busy. Or...
Yeah, I'm leaving it to the last minute, which I think is maybe a mistake. But somewhere near Dijon, I might be going.
Okay.
Yeah.
Steve,
how about you?
I have a weekend here in London, lots of family coming down.
That's the way to go.
Yeah.
I think bank holidays in London, that's where it's at.
In the garden, nice sunny weather.
I'll be here manning the pages.
Great.
I think you've still got to write some pages, haven't you?
I think I might have to, absolutely. But I'm working Monday. I'm off to Hamburg. So,
okay.
Have you been to Hamburg?
I have. I lived there for 3 months.
Did you? I didn't know that.
Yes, I did.
We spent so much time together.
I know. I lived in Altona, a lovely part of them.
What were you doing there?
I was on my year abroad studying German, and I was actually working for the Financial Times Deutschland, which is now sadly no longer. It wasn't to do with me, I have to say. It was a few months after I left.
Oddly, I'm actually meeting some people who used to work on the FT Deutschland. I'm seeing some friends from Gruner & Jahr.
Okay, amazing. Yeah.
Well, there you go.
That's where I work.
How about your history with Hamburg?
I've never been to Hamburg.
Never?
Yeah, seriously. I've never been to Hamburg.
I think you'd like it. Big media city.
I think I would. My German is...
Not as good as Andrew Tuck's.
No. I don't know. I think it's
a maybe, long pause there.
Well, I don't know. I think it's perhaps... It's on a par with Andrew's. It's on a par with Andrew's. I do all the European languages to a certain degree of two or three words.
And we're supposed to start in Italy today, but I think we've landed in Germany. We're in Hamburg. So alerting my colleagues. I think do we have a nimble team on the other side of the glass? I think they can cope with this. I think we should.
Danny's just raised a glass of wine.
So that's a very good sign. We know, of course, gentlemen, over the last year, and it's almost this time last year that the story started to break. Well, maybe about a month out, when we saw the first real surge of migrant traffic in Vienna, all of those trains arriving in Munich and elsewhere, certainly the first eastern ports of entry into Germany. And the story really started to unfold. Now, of course, studies show, of course, that we look at these numbers. It's the largest population growth. Do you want to do the math on this one for us? 1992 to where we are today.
Wow, that's God.
Okay. Economics editor. No
24
longer.
Years.
Thanks.
Good Lord. I was put on the spot there.
Steve, we have, of course, heard a rhetoric from Merkel on one side. There's a humanitarian argument, but also one of just Germany needs these numbers. Here is a European country, one of the world's biggest economies, a very wealthy economy, people, of course, who will be living a very long time, who are simply going to need support, not just in retirement homes, but who will get to driverless vehicles and things robotic later in the program. But if we are going to somehow make the German machine work and work within German borders, not just manufacturing overseas, we will need a labor force as well.
Exactly. From a purely economic, in purely economic terms, lots of West European nations need migrants for two reasons. One, because they need people to do jobs that that people that are there already don't necessarily want to do. And the other is because of the pensions burden. You know, you have all these countries where you have the baby boomer generation that are either retiring now or about to retire, and they are going to need a lot of money for their pensions. And there aren't currently enough workers providing that. So then the issue is about how you do it. And Germany has had an interesting model in the past, something we've looked at in the page of the magazine, whether that is, for example, training nurses in Vietnam ahead of their move to Germany, not only in how to work in a German care home, but how to speak German, and let us teach you about German culture so that when they arrive...
And deal with cranky Germans,
well,
maybe.
Indeed, there is that issue as well. So they've done it in a very organised way in that sense. And then you've got the situation here, obviously, with the refugee flow last summer, where it was more of a humanitarian decision on behalf of from Angela Merkel. And there was an interesting story in one of the British newspapers, The Guardian, this week about how it was a single tweet that essentially opened the doors, sent by the German Interior Ministry, saying in rather dry language, the Dublin Agreement on asylum in the European Union is essentially going to be suspended while we deal with this crisis. And that then led to, it acquired this life of its own, and people started talking about, you know, in Syria, like, right, well, this is how we get into Germany. It would take a long time to see whether the economic impact, how positive the economic impact is. And obviously they're dealing with the social issues as well, as you would expect if you have a population increase of 1 million people, many of whom come from a background that is very different from the majority background in the country itself.
Matt, I was talking to a diplomat from another EU country, someone who spent a lot of time in this studio. I don't want to be cryptic, but I also don't want to implicate this individual either. But she was saying last week that one of the problems that she has in her country are just the sheer number of course, migrants without family, and particularly young men, so unaccompanied minors coming into the country, and who are 16 and 17, who really have no education to speak of. And this fear that it's going to take 6-7 years, a decade, to get these people into the workforce, the issues of self-esteem that go with that, et cetera. How do you deal with this when you hear on one side Merkel say, we can do this, and then you're looking at 20,000, 30,000 unaccompanied minors who are, you know, well past puberty, and then we're trying to get them into the system. Is that just an impossible mountain to climb?
It's interesting. I mean, you're absolutely right. That is the kind of the age group that holds the biggest challenge and the biggest opportunity, because they have an entire life's worth of work ahead of them. So if you can get them into the workforce, earning money and paying taxes, that's a brilliant influx of money for the state. But in the short term, as you say, in that first decade before, you know, they may not speak much English or much German. They may not have, you know, loads of skills or education. It is a huge challenge. And in the first, you know, in the first couple of years, they'll probably be in centres if they're applying for refugee status. It's incredibly tricky in the short term. I think Germany is actually relatively well set up. Its education system is all about having apprenticeships and things that are much more about, you know, manual tasks rather than necessarily going to university and getting a degree in something. But it is such a huge challenge, and it's something that we're seeing, you know, Germany is battling with at the moment. Mm.
Steve, how much do governments, and this is not, it's not just an EU question, this is anywhere in the world, do you have to flex and bend and change values? And you know, and maybe it sort of, it gets us, you know, obviously we're talking about sort of burkinis as well a little bit later in the program. But someone was saying that, and I was in Sweden last week, so someone was saying that it's, you know, it's really entrenched in Swedish society that of course, men and women should be together, and this goes for education, and no one wants to see single-sex schools, etc. So, you know, a year and a half ago, the Swedes were like, you know, every asylum center needs to be co-ed. There needs to be men and women. This is fundamental. It is part of Swedish values. But now, because of numbers, you see the code starting to be rewritten, that it's maybe too dangerous for women, and this huge debate in the country, which it suddenly becomes a debate about Swedish values. Should we be endangering women because you have 85, 90% men in these centers? Or do we deploy more people to protect women? What is your take on this? You know, do we spend too much time on it? And are the Swedes right to dig their heels and say we need to stick by Swedish values? Or does the welfare, potentially, of the women in these centres come first?
I think on the more general issue, there are integration works both ways. It's, I think, a nation has to make sure that it is providing language lessons, for example, and opportunities. But equally, those that arrive in a new country, whether that is a Syrian arriving in the UK or whether it's a British person moving to the Costa del Sol, they also have to make an effort to integrate there. I was in the Netherlands last week for a story for this issue that we're just closing today. And ahead of going there, I was reading over the interview that we did last year with Ahmed Aboutaleb, the mayor of Rotterdam, who's a leading member in the Labour Party on the centre-left in the Netherlands. And he was talking about how the importance for new arrivals in the Netherlands to make a new home in their country and feel like the Netherlands is their home and to commit to it, whilst also at the same time, other Dutch people shouldn't expect them to completely cut their ties with where they're from. He says, it's not about your loyalty to one country or another. You can, you know, in the same way as, you know, my family still have some ties to Eastern Europe, your family still have ties to Estonia. It's, those can still be a part of your culture and your background and who you are. But when you make a decision to move to one country, it's on you. It's incumbent on you to, you've made that choice to live there. You need to do your best to integrate there.
Matt, you said you spent time in Altona when you were in Hamburg. Probably even then it was maybe even a bit too funky for you. I'm not sure. But you know, if you went to Altona, it has a cooler sort of edgier side. Do you think also, you know, we forget in all of this though that, you know, it's not just migrants, you know, coming up against people who are in their 20s or 30s, but you know, there are people who are in their 70s and their 80s as well, who have seen other waves of migration, but have also been through very hard times as well. And we can't expect everyone to turn on a dime just because this has been presented on the 10 o'clock newscast.
Absolutely. And it's that interesting point of, you know, we always talk about migrants moving to new places and having to adapt. But actually, you know, people in their 60s and 70s have had to adapt to their country changing. I mean, over a lifetime, and when you're living, you know, in Germany or anywhere else, you've obviously seen, as you say, waves of migration. You know, in Germany, for instance, they've seen Turkey, the enormous influx of Turkish migrants in the 20th century. And they've had to adapt. And broadly speaking, you know, people in Western Europe have been very, very good at adapting to the new country that their country has become.
We are going to take a very short break. It's just gone quarter past the hour, 18:15 here in London. You are listening to Midori House with me, Tyler Brulé, Steve Bloomfield, Matt Alagaya. When we come back, gentlemen, during the break, we can talk, you know, do we want to lead on driverless cars? Do we want to talk Burkini bands? Or do we want to talk about a very interesting story, which is in the New York Times, it's bubbled up again. And there's a very lovely little newspaper, which is on the blocks in Vermont. Lovely place. We might all want to retire there, but we can talk about that after the break. Stay with us.
Come on, you knew that summer couldn't last forever. It's time to think what happens in a post-lounger world. For a start, you could begin a new business or just make the one you have better. Or you could find out how to make a fortune in TV. Here's what our editors have lined up for you this month.
In the culture section, we ask, what is the future of TV? We bet on the next big formats, territories, writers, and on-screen talent.
In the design pages, we visit the furtive furniture makers bringing Basque design into the limelight.
In the edit section, we sit down with Oscar-winning director Paolo Sorrentino for his filmic final feast, overlooking Rome.
The September issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to find out how.
And welcome back to Midori House Studio One with me, Tyler Brulé, Steve Bloomfield, and Matt Alagaya. Just 18:16 here in London. Before we went away for the break, we were just talking about the record migrant numbers, certainly for the past year in Germany, the biggest since 1992. And we were talking about cultural differences, embracing adaptation, etc. I think this is probably the last we need to do to wade into the Burkini story. I thought Jacques Lang had the last word on it last night. He was on, I don't know if you saw him, Steve, last night. He was on CNN. I think Chris John's on holiday, though. Okay. So I don't think it was on Amanpour. But is that quite strange when you have a program? Like, this is called the Matt Alagaya Show.
Yeah.
But then they say, it's the Matt Alagaya Show.
Presented.
Steve Bloomfield. And then you have to start the program. Steve Bloomfield's away on holidays this week. And yeah. There's something very odd about it. It's very uncomfortable. Yeah. Anyway, Jacques Lang was sitting on his perch wherever CNN does their interviews from, with a very nice view down the Champs-Élysées, and was talking about a variety of things. In fact, he was talking about Sonia Rykiel, and they snuck in a sneaky question at the end, Steve, about the Burkini. Jacques Lang said, he goes, you know, I think it's ridiculous, but he goes, you know, he said, I know, of course, many other people in my country think otherwise. Does this become sort of not necessarily a silly season story, but it is one which has almost come to define the month of August, oddly in a way off the back of a very, very horrible July in Europe?
I find this a horrible story, to be honest, the Burkini. Damage it has done to France's reputation as a liberal nation is, I think, enormous. It's the idea of telling people, particularly women, what they can and cannot wear is what we expect in illiberal nations. And the farcical thing about this is that, you know, the women who are on the beach are integrated. You know, that's the big word. We want these people to be integrated. We don't want to be, you know, hide themselves. The sun came out. They wanted to go to the beach. They didn't decide to stay in their home. They wanted to go onto the beach. And the sight of four armed men standing over a woman as she undresses is a picture that has gone around the world, and I think has done real damage to France as a nation. And there's we can go on to talk about the political implications, but maybe we can move on to something else. But I think we'll see what happens now after this court case, which has said that the ban is unconstitutional, whether it continues. I hope you're right, Tyler. It's a silly season story, and once, you know, the weather's less...
Hopefully it doesn't cool down too much.
Once the weather's less good in France and no one's on the beach, then maybe this won't be an issue anymore.
Matt, just your take on this. Here you have a story, though, which then I think starts to trickle out elsewhere in Europe. So we go to Germany, we go to Scandinavia. It also then becomes a women's issue, though. So if we look at Scandinavia, everyone fighting for women's rights. And yes, everyone at the same time wants to think that everyone's liberal and they can do what they want. But then we also have to deal with child brides, for example, which is not the same as burkinis, but it is also an issue which jars when it comes to the rights of women and how we see women. Should it be a free for all?
It's interesting. I mean, I think that we have to draw a distinction between something like child brides, where that is against the constitutions of many European countries, and the burkini, which is effectively an item of clothing that many women want to wear. I think that's a crucial thing, is a lot of these laws seem to be based on the idea that men in Muslim societies force women to wear hijabs and burkinis. But actually, no one's asked these women whether they've been forced to. These bans have come into play. And I'd actually like to see someone say, well, hang on, maybe we ask the women, and they might just want to wear them. And then it becomes something that they've gone out in public wearing something, and that should be something we completely allow.
Also, the idea that a man that wants his wife to wear a burqa is going to be comfortable in any way with his wife, therefore going into the sea and coming out with her clothes all clingy on her, I think is, it is perhaps not terribly accurate.
Painted a very nice picture for our listeners there.
There we are. I liked that. One thing just on politics, we're going to get on to this and the Foreign Desk Explained this week, but when you have Nicolas Sarkozy coming out so strongly against the burkini, essentially having quite similar language to Marine Le Pen, there is an interesting debate here as to what happens if next April, Sarkozy and Le Pen are the two candidates in the second round. Whereas the left and the people on the centre voted for Jacques Chirac in 2002, will they be comfortable doing that for Sarkozy? I don't know.
When can we tune in to listen?
It will be, if I write it on Tuesday, it will air on Wednesday.
There Very we good. And why don't we stay in the continent for a moment? And certainly, the story which has dominated the news, certainly since the middle of this week, of course, have been the earthquakes in the center of Italy. And, sadly, a death toll which continues to rise. It was quite amazing watching the coverage and incredibly sad at the same time when you see, of course, families torn apart. And then, of course, just extraordinary parts of the country also completely erased. And Steve, one thing that we look at quite often is just the burden, not just on countries within Europe, but it's the same story. Of course, we're working on a big issue on Canada at the moment as well. We've seen the demobilization of mines and everything that's happened with the certainly in the energy sector of the country, how towns suddenly die, sometimes by natural disaster, sometimes because of just the winds of the economy. And we have to make a very tough decision. Do these places, do they get rebuilt? Does it make sense to rebuild them in a Disney-fied manner? Or do we simply move on? So here we have, of course, Renzi pledging this rebuild program. Does it make sense today? Or do you think that, yes, people have ties, but maybe we should think about a new town? And I say new town not meaning something which is architecturally unchallenging, but do you look to rebuild in a very different way, and obviously one which is not going to topple over? Or do you say that there is historical value, tourism is important to these places, so maybe we need to somehow recreate some of these villages that have been lost?
I think emotionally it's important right now. I think it's, if you're from that area and your prime minister comes to visit and says, we won't be beaten by this, we will rebuild, it's an important emotional statement to make. Whether down the road it actually makes sense to do that is an interesting question. And linked to that, I guess, is also the question of whether Italy is capable of rebuilding a town without half the money disappearing. There was the earthquake in Laquia in 2009, and there's an ongoing scandal that's still being dealt with about where the money went there and how the mafia got involved. So there are a whole range of issues that are going to have to be dealt with, and one of them, which I don't think it will be, is this issue that you raise of, you know, do we just simply rebuild? It's often the argument that we should because it feels right. Mm. But as you suggest, sometimes it might make more sense to start again and think about how else to house people.
Is that sort of the brutal hand of the market? What's your take on this? That it, you know, should it be the forces of the market map that say, look, at you know what, there are no people living there. And does it make sense to then you know, have a fire station? And should we just try to get these people closer to another urban center and that we don't have to worry about essential services and a pharmacy and all the other things you expect in your Italian village?
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of those interesting things. You know, there are, I was reading something today on the CNN website, and they reckon there are about 20,000 semi-abandoned towns in Italy. 20,000. And these, you know, Accumoli, which is one of the ones that was hit by this earthquake, they have 600 permanent residents there. And actually, it's one of the kind of the tragedies of this is that it happened in the height of summer when the population of the town does swell to 5,000 from its 600 permanent residents. But, you know, a town with 600 permanent residents, that is, as you say, that's kind of the market talking. There aren't enough jobs in these places to warrant more people living there. So people do move to big cities. And it does have to have a place in this debate, how many of these small towns you need to be constantly spending money on to keep them alive.
Let's go to a small town on the very far side of the Atlantic right now, Hardwick, Vermont. Interesting story in the New York Times. It's one they've been revisiting. We've seen it in some other U.S. papers as well. Headline is Want to Own a Newspaper, Vermont Contest has trouble finding takers. And it tells the story of a 71-year-old editor of a small town paper, the Hardwick Gazette. He wants to retire. Ross Connolly is running a contest to decide his worthy successor, and he's looking for 700 people to write an essay describing why they want the gig. The entry fee, well, it's $175, and he's hoping that the fees will cover his building, computers, and taxes, plus a tidy retirement. This interesting business model. Maybe some big city daily should take this on as well.
It's unfortunate. I mean, unfortunately, he had to extend.
You would look good in Vermont, by the way.
Really?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, well, what are you basing that on? I'm intrigued by this.
Yeah,
I've never been, you know, so I'm...
That was your choice of socks early in the week.
Okay, yes, of course, yeah. So, I mean, unfortunately, he had to extend the contest because not enough people applied. So I'm not sure if it is a completely foolproof and workable model that could be rolled out across the country. But, you know, I think it's an inspiring story. You know, people...
The paper's been going since 1889.
Look, Tyler, I should be honest here. It was $175 well spent. I've written my essay. Ross likes it. I'm off. There's this wonderful quote from him.
I hear them boarding the flight to Boston now. So.
There's a wonderful quote from him.
Yeah.
He said about like, why he thinks there weren't enough entries. He says, maybe the people who have experience know that you're not going to get rich and you're going to work your butt off. The hours are long and the pay is not great. And so they were smart enough to say, I don't want any part of this.
Mm.
It's
I think
sad,
there's something
it?
Wonderfully romantic, though, just as we come into autumn, leaves are changing. Which I think maybe it's black and white paper, I don't know. But I think it could be very, very nice.
I really do. I mean, if I lived in Vermont and I was, you know, and I didn't have a job right now, I would consider it.
Right.
I don't know if I'd want to pay to... I think this is a thing. I don't want to necessarily pay... to have a job interview,
right.
Essentially.
No,
that feels a bit wrong.
$175.
Yeah,
I'm getting sort of overly. I went to college in Vermont, so I'm sort of feeling overly romantic about the whole thing.
Would you go back and edit the Hardwick Gazette?
Listen, if the terms were right, you know, if I was, you know, the venture that we're currently sitting in, you know, if I was able to sell this for, you know, a fair sum and have a nice rambling
for $175, so they could afford the entry fee.
Maybe, right?
Could you be a seasonal owner? Go there every autumn.
I think the idea of that, now there is a business idea, is the seasonal newspaper.
Yeah.
Just before we go, I talked about driverless cars at the top of the show. We shouldn't disappoint our listeners. Let's say there's a driverless car waiting for you right outside right now the studio to take you home. Interested?
Absolutely. I can't wait. I'm tired of driving already.
What you wish for.
Absolutely.
Can you drive?
I can drive.
You can drive.
Not,
okay.
Haven't been able to drive for very long, but I do have a pink license, which means
what
I
does
can
that mean?
Drive.
Pink license.
A pink license. It's green when it's provisional. It's pink. Come on.
Is it?
Okay.
Do you not remember?
Sure.
But yeah, I can't wait for them to come in. I think that'd be
Steve,
wonderful.
I can wait. I actually quite like driving, so
right.
I don't
love driving as well.
I don't want to just sit there while it does it for me, and I just wouldn't trust it.
It's fraught with problems.
Yeah.
Anyway, anyone can read the FT last week. How's that going to happen in Munich? I was just thinking bicycles, prams, tourists who don't look the right way? Because I think the car is never going to be aggressive enough to sort of pull out in traffic. And anyway.
Also, in Amsterdam, where I was this week, it was... Oh, God, no.
There's lots of bicycles a bit.
There's not enough time for you.
Three times I almost got hit by a bicycle.
There is not enough time. We have to go, gentlemen. That's all for today's edition of Midori House. The show is produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Molly Ingleby. Our studio manager has been Kieran Matthew Banerjee. Did I get that right? More music next. Marcus is here at 1900. Have a very, very good long weekend if you're on the side of the Atlantic. Goodbye.